will hear our speaker, and we believe it's only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that we will be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Julie's got it. She really does. So please come up here, Julie. Tell us how you did it.
Thank you, Tim. I'm Julie, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm really glad to see everybody here tonight. I'd like to start my story off with the numbers and the calculations, because if you're like me, when you listen to somebody's story, you spend about the first 5 minutes trying to figure out when they start rattling off their how old they are and their sobriety date and all this stuff. You're doing it on your hand, you know, how much time that is. And you're like, oh, dang, I forgot to carry the one, and it's no way, 73. And so anyway, I'll tell you all that first. And I have some notes, not because I don't know my own story, but because, trust me, you do not want me to go on a tangent. We'll be here all night. I was born on May 23rd, 1961. That means coming May, I will be celebrating the Big 5-0. That's right, the Big 5-0. My sobriety date is February 25th, 1995. So if I don't die and I don't drink, I'm going to have 16 years and 4 days. This means I was pushing about 34 when I came into the program. So what's like, what's happened, and what's it like now? I'd like to tell you that it was all about sex, drugs, and rock and roll. But there were no drugs, and there was no rock and roll. And as for the sex, you know, I'm not going to kiss and tell, so I don't want to disappoint you. I'm sorry about that. But anyway, I did say I was born in 1961. I was the last of 6 children, 5 of whom who survived through infancy. My oldest brother died in infancy. And so there were 4 girls and 1 boy, and I was the baby. I was born in Memphis, Tennessee, about a mile from Elvis. And it was really an idyllic early childhood. You know, we had a large family, kind of center of the neighborhood kind of home, a lot of fun, everybody playing all the time, walked to elementary school, really walked to elementary school. You know, both of my parents, however, were alcoholics, but they did a very good job of covering that up. So you really kind of had to be in our household all the time to know that there was, you know, an alcohol problem there, because they could dress up real pretty and go out and have a good time with all their buddies, and you would never really would know. So when I was 11, we moved to Tampa, Florida, and it was a really beautiful place to grow up. I did, however, you know, I showed up in Tampa at 11 years old, you know, at the beginning of puberty, and I was this real hick of a kid, you know. Nobody in Tampa speaks Southern. They're not Southern. Memphis, you're from Memphis, you're Southern. And so I get there, and I'm, you know, a little chubby, and I'm all 9 and 5 and 10 and git, and they're like, what the heck is this? Oh, welcome to our town, you know. You know, I'd like to say that I had a good transition there, but it was a little rocky at first. They didn't know who I was. I didn't know who they were. And I was beginning to notice at that point the effects of alcohol on my family. My father was becoming much more angry drunk. When he would get drunk, it wasn't so much more fun, as fun. My mother was just completely emotionally unavailable. And it seemed like there was always somebody leaving our dinner table in tears. Always somebody leaving our dinner table in tears. And somewhere in there, I vowed that that would never be me. I made some kind of conscious or unconscious decision, and I said, that will not be me. You will not get me to cry over something as stupid as X, Y, or Z. Well, that was just the beginning of the hardening of my life, I guess I would say. I also became pretty dogmatic about drinking. I felt like alcohol was bad. I thought people who drank were bad. I thought people who smoked were bad. People who did drugs were bad. And I got to be really obnoxious about it, sort of like a little Carrie Nation running around with my axe and making sure that everybody knew how I felt about it. And I don't know if y'all remember, but in PE, did y'all remember, like, the coach would every once in a while pass out those pamphlets about alcohol and alcohol abuse and stuff? Well, I would bring them home, and at night, I would, before I went to bed, I would see my mom in the den, sitting there watching TV, drinking her bourbon, smoking her cigarettes, with her back to me, and I would strategically place those pamphlets in the middle of the kitchen floor, you know, as if they had fallen out of my books or something, you know. And every morning they'd be gone, and they wouldn't be back up on the counter. So I don't know what she did with them. I don't know if she ever even looked at them, but I know I did that at least twice. It was just, you know, my way of trying to get to her. You know, when you're little and you're young, you can't really do anything about it. But I will tell you that my isms were there from the very beginning. I was rigid and judgmental and a pessimist. I felt alone and apart. I didn't feel popular. But, I mean, if you look through the yearbooks, it appears that I was kind of popular. I didn't feel that way. I didn't feel pretty. I didn't feel lovable. I never felt like I was enough. And, you know, you hear that description in this room all the time. And I don't know if you identify with that, but that is how I felt all of the time. And real or unreal, it was real for me. It was true enough for me. I'll just tell you a quick story, kind of give you an idea of what kind of how difficult it is to be that kind of person at a young age. And my sister and I was about 13, and my sister was probably 19. And we went to the mall, and we were coming out of the mall, and there was this, we're in the parking lot, and it's this gorgeous flock of birds in the sky, just gorgeous. And my sister's like, oh, wow, look, you know, and I look up, I'm 13, and I, you know what I said? Oh, great, we're going to get shit on, all right? And she just stopped dead in the parking lot and dropped her jaw and looked at me like, you know, how does a 13-year-old get like that? You know, I have no idea. I have no idea. But I remember it like yesterday because she was stunned that that was my first thought, you know? I mean, it wasn't about the pretty bird. Now, about this time, I told you that there were no drugs in my story, and I'll tell you why. About this time, my brother, my only brother, my dear, dear friend, my handsome, beautiful brother, was about 15, played tennis, really a gorgeous guy, and loved by everybody, and he had in one day a massive nervous breakdown and spent years in and out of psychiatric hospitals with every diagnosis under the sun, from schizophrenia to manic depression to you name it. He was on every one of those mid-70s drugs that you put kids on, Lorazine, all of those ones. So what does that have to do with me and drugs? Well, at one point, the doctors were saying that he and his buddies had just started experimenting with marijuana. And the doctors had said, you know, there are some people whose brains simply cannot handle any of this kind of stuff. And we think maybe that's what happened to your brother. And that one dose and you're gone, I guess. But that frightened me very much. And so I never did it. I've never done an illegal drug. I'm the only person my age I know who has never done an illegal drug. And I did go to the University of Florida, and so I probably had some secondhand smoke during the football games. There was plenty of secondhand smoke in the stadium. Pretty thick sometimes too, as I recall. But I never actually did those things. But now I certainly drank alcohol illegally because we drink and drive. Now that is illegal even if you don't get caught. It came time for me to go to college, and I wanted to go to journalism school, so I chose the University of Florida. It's only a couple hours away. I think I did that so that I could stay closer to my family and be closer to my brother, because I never knew when the shoe was going to drop there. I will tell you that now he's miraculously a completely different person and snapped out of it at about 22 and is an extremely successful person, member of society and what have you. He has a son and a wife and all that. But the drinking age in Florida was 18 at the time that I went to the University of Florida. So I started drinking. I was legal. But anyway, I show up in Florida and I'm really morally against drinking. And but I'm also wound tighter than any top you can possibly imagine. And So my freshman year, my friend Anne-Marie showed up in the dorm when we were going to all go to the SAE house and have a big party, and she showed up with the vodka and orange juice, and she said, "You're having a drink," because I don't think they wanted to go out with me anymore without me ever having another drink, loosening up a little bit. So we did. I did. I remember it like this yesterday. I remember what it tasted like. I remember what it felt like. I remember suddenly being released from my prison. I mean, I have pictures from that night because it was a big party at SAE, and I have that sheet looking green on my face. I'm just the happiest little child on the whole planet, and I could not wait to do it again. And you know, you hear that here in these rooms a lot, too. Regular people don't remember that. I mean, every moment of their first drink, I do. And I couldn't wait to do it again. And none of my moral convictions were there anymore. I mean, not a single one. I didn't care. I thought drinking was great. So that kind of told me a little bit, tells me something. And I'm not a doctor, but I think it means that it might be hereditary and that there might be something in my body that says, once you put that in here, you're going to want more of it. Because you couldn't have the moral stance that I had 5 minutes before I drank that screwdriver and completely throw that out the window if you didn't have some kind of physiological response to that drink, in my opinion. So, and plus, you know, I mean, my parents were alcoholic, and I had this grandmother who we found out after she died, we were going through some of her stuff, and she had convinced, and we were going through her tax files, and she had convinced a doctor to let her write champagne off as a medical expense. So I think it might have been in my family, but I have to say I was born with a congenital hole in my soul, not my heart. But anyway, so within a month, I'm getting shit-faced every time I drank. I mean, I just didn't drink just socially. I just had to have as much as I possibly could. And one of the times that I really remember is, if y'all have been to fraternity parties, sometimes the guys will make punch for the ladies, and they'll put what's known as grain alcohol punch or grain alcohol in the punch. And the SAEs had a trash can as big as the ones back there of grain alcohol punch sitting in the middle of the floor. And you know, I started drinking it, and in about 30 minutes, you know, I was no longer using the ladle. I was just dumping the cup right there into the vat, you know. And about 15 minutes after that, my best friend in Tampa, her brother was an SAE, and he was sort of always looking after me. And he came up to me and he said, "Julie, you know, there really is alcohol in that." You know, because they were like, we tell them there's no alcohol in there, ha ha. But he came up to me and said, "No, there really is," you know. So I was like, yeah, I know. Well, I mean, by the end of the night, y'all, my hand was purple. I mean, it just took my whole hand in there. I think I would have put my face in it if I could have. I may have. In fact, I might have. I don't remember. But I do know that, you know, once again, one of the fall of 79 pledge class members had to drive me home to the dorm, and, you know, Jimmy would just hold up his keys and say, "Somebody, you know, make sure she didn't kill herself on the way home and get her there." So I should put them on my eight-step list, if you remember. If you happen to be a pledge in 79 at Florida, SA, I apologize. You probably got me home one time or another. Let's see. Oh, the other thing that happened was when I got home that first weekend after having had that first drink, and I made my first drink at home, I can tell you for the first time I felt welcomed by my family. My mother was so glad to see that tight and wound daughter finally relax, and I felt like I was a part of the family for the first time ever. So I did very well in college, and by my sophomore year, I got my first serious boyfriend. I don't need to spell that out for y'all, do I? I told y'all I wasn't going to kiss and tell. But, I got my first serious boyfriend. I was in love with him and what have you. And I got really active in campus activities, and I was in the leadership organizations and the academic honoraries and the sororities and all that stuff. And I was looking, you know, it looked all really good on the outside, but on the inside, I was dying. You know, the first serious boyfriend just drifted away, just left. I didn't know why. You know, it might have had something to do with him that he had to pour me into the Jeep every time we went out. And, you know, I'm like, this is not walking. You know, it's, you know, dragging me along is not walking. But, so he left. And I was just dying on the inside. And so by my senior year, my friends would be going out and having a good time, and I'd be in my apartment drinking alcohol, and I would drink, and I would put on Desperado, and I would cry me up a storm, and I would just cry Desperado. Why doesn't anybody love me? How come nobody loves me? And it dawned on me 20 years later, how many years later, and when I was listening to that song sober, that the song doesn't have anything to do with nobody loving you. It says, why don't you let somebody love you? Okay, I got it. Well, the problem was with me was that, it's really hard to hug a porcupine. And I was a porcupine, and anything that I didn't like, it was just, defenses up. And so, you couldn't hug me. I wouldn't let you. We wouldn't let you come within a country mile of me. You know what I mean, in terms of actually getting to know me. And so, that's why nobody loved me. I wouldn't let anybody. Anyway, I graduated, the very long school, moved to St. Petersburg, Florida for my first job. So if you don't know, St. Petersburg is known as the home of the newlywed and nearly dead, and nothing much in between. And I was making $11,000 a year. I was an advertising copywriter for a department store, and I was writing those little circulars that you get in the mail and that you probably throw away. That's what I did for a living. And I have to quickly tell the story, but there was a woman who worked there with us, an older woman, she's like 65, and she was just lovely. And since we worked in a mall, we'd go down and sit in the mall, and I would just wax poetic about what have you, on and on and on. And I was so sure of everything I said, and she turned to me one day and she said, "Hi, sweet, my, I've never met anybody so young, so set in their ways." And I thought that was a compliment. I thought she was saying I knew that I knew what I was talking about, and that I was smart, and I could make a decision and stick with it. Well, I rode that compliment into these rooms, y'all. It's not necessarily a good thing to be set in your ways, but I moved up in my career. I left that job. I moved over to Tampa, where there were some actual 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds, and started working for a subsidiary of GTE, which is now Verizon, and was on the fast track. Single, young, fairly attractive, having a great time. Really sort of a go-getter, kind of person. If it could be done, I wanted to do it. I wanted to have the hardest job that you could give me. I didn't really date much like my friends were, but I did have quite a few encounters. So if I didn't really date, I had encounters. And Desperado. But eventually, my friends started getting married and that kind of thing, and I didn't. I just kept drinking, kept trying to find somebody else to drink with. And about that time, I got into a really sick relationship with an alcoholic Brit. And this was a very complicated and dishonest relationship, and crazy as all get out. And so that meant I was in love, because it was crazy. And so about that time, in 1989, I moved to Dallas for GT because I was on the fast track. I'm young, I'm single, everybody needs to move, you move. So I, first day of that job, I needed to fly out of Tampa, actually to California, but I needed to go to California for the first day of that job. And I had stayed up the night before drinking so much that I woke up to the sound of the taxi driver banging on the door. And trust me, it was not a good day for the first day. I spent most of it, on an airplane shaking like this, and the rest of it in a meeting shaking like this, just waiting for them to call dinner time so we could go get some more alcohol. And that was the beginning. I was on the fast track, y'all. This is the woman who was going to do it all. And that's how I spent my first day on that job. And through a combination of events, coupled with my full-blown alcoholism, within 10 months, I was suicidal and on my knees. It was October of that year, and I was a mess. Now, I had worked harder than my life than I've ever worked before. I had won awards from my business for my profession. I had flown all over. I'd done all these things, but I was really a mess. And it was a combination of things. So it wasn't just the alcoholism. I mean, there was, you know, there were some what they call classic depressive things going on, like moving. And the Brit that I was so in love with, he dropped dead of a heart attack. But I it was very sad. But I can pretty much tell you I'd be dead if he hadn't. I think I'd be in the ditch in England somewhere after we'd driven off the road coming home from a pub or something. I don't know that for a fact, but that's where we were headed. And it was that and this, and then I worked with this crazy woman, and I was suicidal. So I did what all responsible 29-year-old women do when they're down in the luck. I quit. And I moved to Atlanta to live with my parents at 29 years old. I don't recommend that, but they were good enough to take me back in. So I ended up in Atlanta, jobless and broken. And I was at my bottom. And then I bottom fed for another 6 years. I drank with my parents. I drank with my sister, who still lives here. We hit Atlanta hard. I mean, we were out at Aunt Charlie's and playing the bocce ball and everything. We hit it hard. Desperado. A lot of desperado going on those days. Oh, it was so much fun to take that song out and play it and weep. And then in September of 1991, I went into a bar to meet up with a friend of mine, and I was tapped on the shoulder, and I turned around, and there was this really tall, really good-looking guy standing there, and he said, "I went to journalism school with you." It had been 10 years since I'd been in school, and I said, "Oh, yeah, you know what, you did," and I recognized him, and something miraculous happened that day, and every day after that, and that was that he did not go away. Bless his heart. He did not go away. And there's got to be something about him that, you know, would keep him around when I was doing the things I was doing. But he saw something in me that I guess I didn't know was there. And he didn't leave, and he still hasn't left. So that's the good part of my story at that point in my life. That's the saving grace right there. And I was pretty well known for having a real acidic sense of humor and just sort of calling it like it is, pulling no punches, taking all comers. What would you say? Just, you know, being a bit of a tough cookie. And again, because you put the whole porcupine thing, you know, you don't get close to me. And if you do, you know, watch out. But I was now becoming a very angry drunk, okay? And it was very ugly. I did not know why that man did not go away. Y'all would have to ask him that. Says something about him, I guess. Anyway, one of the stories I like to tell is that, you know, Bill Wilson talks about having brawls with the taxi driver. And, you know, I just got to laugh when I had totally forgotten that until I read Bill's story. I'm like, yeah, I had a brawl with a taxi driver once. You know, I had this friend who was by this point I was working for a subsidiary of British Telecom. And I had a friend who had come over from London who was here for work and for about a week, and he had paid a taxi driver to basically hang out and just wait for him to need to go places. So my friend and this guy, Don, had gotten to be very friendly with each other. And so I gave my friend Harry the directions to my fiancé's in my apartment, and he gave them to Don, and sure enough, eventually I got the phone call from Don as they were late saying he was lost. So I was trying to give Don, the taxi driver, some instructions, and he just didn't seem to be able to get it. Now, the fact that I had been pre-drinking probably didn't help much, but, you know, he had to drink to go out to drink. And anyway, at some point, Don, the taxi driver, got a little frustrated with me, and he said, "What are you, just a stupid woman?" And from the back seat, I hear my British friend say, "Uh-oh." That was a mistake, bloke. And so luckily my fiancé was in the parking lot when they arrived, because I would have had an actual physical altercation with the taxi driver had he not been. But I definitely told him that I didn't think he could find certain parts of his body and stuff like that. So anyway, that's just kind of how it was, though. I mean, if I could argue with you, or you made me mad, just here come the quills. So very angry drunk. But what happened? What happened? I drank. And my husband and I, my boyfriend, eventually fiance, moved in together. And basically, I would drink myself to blackout every night and then get up and go to work the next morning. And I would not remember what he said to me. I would next morning come out of the bathroom and say, you know, oh, we need to talk about XYZ. And he'd say, yeah, I know. We talked about it last night. And that happened so many times that I can't tell you how many times, but it was really demoralizing because I didn't know what we had discussed. You know, I didn't know if we were flying to New York or driving to Athens, Georgia. I don't know. I mean, I really, half the time I'd had to kind of figure out without letting him know that I didn't have a clue. And I would also do things like, while I was watching Seinfeld, I would write down what it was about. And that's pretty sad, y'all, because that show was about nothing. And I had to write that down. But I wrote it down so that the next day at work, with the people talking about it, I could say, oh, yeah, Kramer was so funny, ha-ha. You know. I didn't want anybody to know. I couldn't watch a show about nothing and remember any of it. Anyway, so my husband, my fiancé at the time, every morning did the same thing, still does, makes me a cup of tea, brings it to the bedside, goes about his business. Now, I was getting up later and later, sicker and sicker, and you know, you can only have a stomach flu so many times in a week before it gets suspicious. And I remember one day I was lying in the bed moaning and with the pillow over my head, and I was kind of looking out. Tea was cold, always got cold. And my husband was in the walk-in, my fiance was in the walk-in closet, and he turned and he looked at me from the closet, and I could still feel light behind him, and he said, oh, for God's sake, get up! And I just couldn't believe it. He grabbed his coat and stormed out. And he had never done that, ever. And I was lying there, and I said to myself, or I said to my head, in my head, God help me. And that afternoon, I finally told my psychiatrist, I was seeing a psychiatrist for depression. I was consuming massive doses of a depressant every night. There's no surprise that I might be depressed. Finally told her I was an alcoholic. And within 2 weeks, I was in Ridgeview. And it was something I really wanted to do because I had a moral, emotional, spiritual bottom. I had a fiance, I had a job, I had a car, I was planning my wedding, you know, but I had nothing. I had nothing. My soul was gone. And I couldn't live like that. And I guess I'm just really glad that I had a very, very low or high bottom. So I checked into Ridgeview on February 25th, 1995. So drank for 15 years. And I just got it right away. I think the minute they said to me, we need to take your perfume and your shampoo, that's when I got it. But there's some pretty sick people in here if they think I'm going to drink my shampoo. And they're taking it because somebody must have already done that before. So anyway, I don't know. I just really, as soon as I got in there, I felt safe for the first time ever since I'd been drinking. And they gave me a big book. And I was reading the book, and I got to the third step prayer, and I was in the little room, and I was reading it, and I had as close to a white light experience as I can ever describe. I can't describe it. I really can't. I just know that when I read that sentence, release me from the bondage of myself, it's like I could feel that there was a possible solution to this. And that I might have to get off of my intellectual high horse and admit there might be a God. It wasn't me. And it wasn't alcohol. And although I certainly had let it become that. And it wasn't my husband. It wasn't money. It was something else outside of me. And I heard a woman say the other day that when we're ready to get it, it's when the clarity meets the grace. And that is the best way I can describe to you what it felt like when I read that sentence. And those of you who are nodding, I think, have had similar experiences. And if you haven't, you will be contacted, I promise, if you stay here. So when I was leaving Reggie, I was checking out, and I was standing next to the reception area, and the receptionist nurse there said, "Well, Julie, how do you feel?" And I said, "I'm scared. The door's locked here. There's no alcohol here, And she said, "Oh, that's good. Thanks a lot." And she said, "But no, really, seriously, the people who leave here laughing are the ones we're worried about, And I really was a little scared at the beginning, because I knew that I had this real desire for alcohol. And before I left, I called my husband and I said, "Could you do me a favor?" I said, "Could you wrap up all the wine glasses and put them away?" Which is kind of funny, because I always just use the same one anyway. But we had them all up there. And the same one was always the same one, Just like my mother had always used the same bourbon glass. I mean, the same one for years. I won't go there. But anyway, I get home. My husband was not there. And in the middle of the countertop is this big mound of wads of newspaper, all of which are shaped like wine glasses. And I thought, okay, that was when I realized no non-alcoholic is ever going to be able to help me do this program, because, that was his best effort at putting up the wine glasses, and he does not and cannot and still does not understand what that feels like, okay? So, I got my sponsor when I shared a story at a meeting out at Ridgeview about how I started crying when I went to a restaurant for the first time with my husband after getting sober, and started crying because there was a wait for the table, and I used to love that. That meant I could go into the bar, and we sat down, and I just was crying. I couldn't believe that I wasn't going to get to go into the bar and drink some. And my husband was really sweet. He's like, "Do you want to leave? I'm like, "No, I got to go to restaurants. I got to be out and about." And so I shared that story with somebody at a meeting at Ridgeview, and a woman shared, and she said, "Well, honey, no wonder, my God, you just lost your best friend." And that clicked with me. And I reached out to her, and I asked her to help me, and she did. And believe me, I really thought the four hardest words I would ever say were, "I am an alcoholic." And I got in here, and I found out the four hardest words to say are, "Will you help me?" Because I was self-sufficient to the core and had the porcupine thing going on. I've had so many beautiful experiences working the steps, and could talk to you for more like hours about them. And I won't do that to you. I won't submit you to that. But I will tell you that my first fourth step, I only did it because I was coming up on a year, and I felt like that would be a bad AA if I didn't do it within a year. And I made all kinds of excuses before I did it, just like I read some of these we balked. And I balked. I said I could not make columns in Microsoft Word, so therefore I could not do a four step. I still cannot make columns in Microsoft Word. But then eventually somebody in the 545 said, "Look, just get out a piece of paper and write 'God help me' and start writing. Write 'God help me' across the top." So I did that. And my first fourth step was a fearless and searching moral inventory of everybody else in my life but me. Because I was too angry to see that I had a part in any of it. And there are people in this room who were there, and they'll tell you afterwards that's absolutely positively true. Very angry. And I did the best that I could, and I proved to myself right there, and I hopefully can prove to other people there is no wrong way to do it. It would have got, had it been graded by a professor, it would have gotten an F. Cannot follow directions, right? Well, the direction is about yourself. I didn't know. I couldn't see that. So anyway, the best part about doing it incorrectly was that when I got to my fifth step and I went to my sponsor's home and spit all that out and cursed and screamed and called names and blamed and got the hell all over her pretty white carpet. She listened. Boy, she listened to that, and she said, "Bless you." She said, she probably was thinking, "Bless you," but she said, "Just an exclamation." I mean, really, we shouldn't talk much more. She just said, "My, what a sad, angry, lonely little girl you are." The big book says you're supposed to like feel the breeze through your hair or something after the fifth step, and I didn't feel that. Didn't feel that at all. But I had been given the one piece of information that not a single soul on the planet had the balls to ever say to me. And that was divine intervention. Something about that sweet little, I mean, she wasn't more than this tall, southern lady said that to me, and something told her, now, say it now. And thank God she did. Because there and now I have something I can work on. Oh, I'm getting to the problem. No wonder it's so hard to be a part of society and why I'm running up against people and it's always just this way instead of that way. Because I'm 4 years old, running around in a 35-year-old body. And so I got an opportunity to sit with that for a while. And I will tell you that I spent, unfortunately, a few years before I went back, or before I went forward with 6, 7, 8, 9. I stayed in that piece of information for a long time, and I started having babies and getting promotions and doing that kind of thing and having too much busy to do anything else. But I decided that it was time to do another 4-step. So I did finally do a 4-step correctly. It was probably a C+ instead of an F. But it gave me a list of defects, and it gave me something that I could work on. And I was glad for that. I was really, really glad for that. I came to my home group the next day after having my 5th step done and having this list of character defects. And I said, "You guys, I just don't get it. I mean, it's so confusing. It's, you know, entirely ready to have God remove this and humbly ask that. I don't get it. I don't know. What do I do? What do I do? Do I just stop doing this stuff? Do I just stop doing this stuff?" And all their heads start going, yeah, you just stop doing it. How do you do that? You know? So anyway, I heard some great advice. And at this point, I realized, you know, I'm not trying to change who I am. I'm trying to change how I am. Because I can't change who I am. I'm just a rolling stone of stuff happening to me. That's who I am. But I can certainly change how I am. And this is when I became aware of that at step 6 and step 7. And, you know, a sweet man in that meeting, he said, "Look, sometimes it's hard to learn to change how to do things." He said, "But try little things first, like move your watch to another arm or buy another kind of toothpaste." I mean, oh my God, when he said that, I thought, no, hell, anyway, no, I'm not going to buy another pair of socks from toothpaste. I'm using Colgate for 45 years. No, of course, you know, as soon as I said that in my head, I started laughing. I'm like, well, this is the point, you ding dong. You know, everything is changeable. It will be okay, you know? And so, you know, and he would say, you know, when everybody's going out to dinner, you don't get a vote. So if they pick Ethiopian food, guess where you're going for dinner? You know, even if you thought you were going to go get a nice, thick, juicy steak, you ain't doing it. Shut up and go to the Ethiopian restaurant. Don't say anything. Be polite. You know, and that's hard for me to do because I realized at that point that I spent a lot of my life kind of manipulating people to get to what I wanted. You know, go to the right movie, do this, do that. So anyway, I'm not going to tell the clock story. But anyway, step 7, God gave me an opportunity to really have a humble experience and show my, you know what, and dig down to one of those character defects. And I call it the clock story. And if you ever want to hear it, come to the Wednesday 12 and 12 study at 9:30. Because every time we get to step 7, I will tell it. But, you know, in a nutshell, I tried to cheat somebody, and I was sober, y'all. I'd been sober a long time. I tried to cheat him out of a lot of money, and because he didn't know that something I was trying to sell him was broken. It was horrible. I went and gave the money back to the man. I mean, and I felt like a 5-year-old returning the candy to the drugstore. And that's what you know, the kind of lesson that God will give us if we stay here. Now, does that sound like the kind of lesson everybody wants to have? No. But if I can stay open to the fact that these are the kind of lessons I need to remind myself of who I am, or how I am, I should say, and that who I am can change by the way I respond to life and to society. So I came to step 8. My sponsor was very helpful here as well, because I had a lot of things on there that maybe didn't need to be on there, and some things that didn't need to be on there. And so she was very helpful with that. In terms of 9, I have been given up. I've done pretty much every kind of 9 step you can do, except for any gravesite ones. I haven't needed to do that. Both my parents, though gone now, were alive when I got sober. And I was able to go to them and try to make a financial amends to them, because, you know, when you're 29 and you come back home and you live there for a couple of years, you spend a little bit of their money and drink a lot of their alcohol. And so I tried to do that, and, you know, it was a beautiful response from them, and it helped me move on with my life as a parent and as everything else. I have a sister who whose nickname is the Sister from Hell. And well, I've tried, y'all. I really have tried. And this has taught me. I'm not going to win everybody back. I can't. You know, y'all have 16 years and 4 days. And she and I cannot be in the same room together. And this just breaks my heart. But I can't do anything about it. And that one day, when I was about 5 years sober, God spoke to me and said, write your sister a letter and apologize. So I did it, and I was really excited about it, and I watched the postman drive off with it, and then I picked up the phone and I called my sponsor and said, I'm so excited, I just wrote Nina a letter, and I apologized, and I just watched the postman take it away, and there was dead silence. And then she said, you did what? Don't ever do that without talking to me again. I took initiative. I was like, again, you know, she had the ability to say things to me that a lot of people were scared to say to me. And so I got a letter about a week later from my sister, and it started off with, I no longer associate with evil people. So I suggest if you're going to write a letter to somebody that you think you're apologizing, that you talk to your sponsor before you do that, because it may be not written the way you think it is being written. The other thing I did, you know, that I've made phone calls, I've gone back and forth, and, you know, I've had great reactions, I've had some humiliating reactions, you know, you name it. I mean, remember me telling you about the first serious boyfriend? Well, I thought, I gotta, just a few years ago, y'all, I've been thinking about him, thinking about how badly I treated this poor 19-year-old kid trying to drag my drunk butt all over Gainesville. And so I found him on the internet, and I called him up. He didn't remember me. Man, was that humiliating. He started to remember after a while, but it wasn't like he was like thinking about me as much as I was thinking about him. Let's put it that way. So anyway, I still get to do 10 steps, and I'm not very good at 11 steps, but I have been given an opportunity to do service work and to sponsor people and to carry this message in a lot of different ways, and I couldn't be more grateful for that. And God has given me 2 beautiful children who are 14 and 12 and a half, and I'm getting the joy and the pleasure of watching them grow up and sharing some of this program with them a little bit as they mature, showing them that there is a God, and growing every day in my relationship with my husband and with them and with my friends. Society now comes to me and asks me to do things for it. That is amazing. It's just amazing. It's a miracle. And so, you know, there's no more desperado going on. I let some people in. I let some people love me. And through that, I got sober. And I got to be a better person and a member of society. And I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world. So I beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. And you will reap these rewards. Come down from your fences and open the gate and let somebody in. Just let one person in. That's all it takes. And thank you for helping me stay sober tonight. Thank you.
No quills at all. Nice hug. Thank you. Well, who feels like taking a drink? Who thinks they're going to wake up sober in the morning? Okay, awesome. Hey, this, the basket's going around. The seventh tradition states that no dues or fees for AA membership, but we can't do this thing without you guys, as you can, contributing. We're putting speaker recordings on the website where you can go and play them at will. Right now, we're almost about have 100 speakers now, getting close to that. And it's all because of your generosity, really, that y'all come and show up. And let's see the chips. Mr. Bird, would you hand out the chips? Come over here.
Everybody, my name is Paul. My friends call me Big Bird. I am an alcoholic. And this meeting, like so many other AA meetings around the world, because it is a worldwide fellowship, we have chiefs designate your time to sobriety. And if you're ready to give up the cost of high cost of low living, start living our way of life, you can come up here and get this white chip, which means you might want to stop drinking. And if you've been sober 30 days and nights and abstain from alcohol and all their mind-altering substances, you can come up and get this 30-day chips made out of aluminum. Anybody got 30 days? This next one's red. It's for 90 days. Anybody celebrating 90 days tonight? This next one's for 6 months. It's half a cake, half a birthday there. Anybody got 6 months tonight? Next one's for 9 months. Is anybody celebrating 9 months tonight? Last but not least, this blue one's for a year and multiples thereof. Anybody have a birthday tonight that we don't know about?
Number 2. It was God and AA, first and foremost. Great sponsorship and going to a real strong number.
My name is Garrett. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Garrett.
This is one here. How did I do it? Asked the guy to sponsor me, home group, complete a band, and to admit that I wasn't the smartest person in the universe. I would be wrong. I give other people what was given to me.
We always offer this white chip one more time because it's the most important chip to get. You can't get any of the others unless you get this one. Anybody want to reconsider on a white chip? Congratulations on the chips you hold.
Thanks, Paul. If you have any AA-related announcements, we can announce them now. Yes, sir.
February 26th, Zone is sponsoring a dinner and a speaker meet here now. Fired up the hallway.
Yeah, dinner's at 6:30, and the speaker's at 8.
Okay.
Yeah, good.
Speaker's Charlie Young, I think.
Charlie Young, Savannah, Georgia. It's going to be great. Actually, I think last year's Sunday speaker will be telling the story in a couple of weeks. I'll tell you more about that. But he's going to be coming back here. Any other announcements right now? Got anything, Tim? Okay. Well, next week, Neil D. of Knott's Landing. Neil been sober quite some time. Kind of a colorful fellow, don't want to spoil the story, but he has a little bit of time in Times Square under his belt. So it's going to be fun to hear about that exact part of his drinking career, I'm sure. And then the week after that, on March the 7th, our speaker is Lyle P., who is... His home group is Stockbridge Group, and he is in the big book. His story is found on page 522 of the fourth edition. And he was a Northwest Airline pilot that came back all the way and ended up... well, he'll tell you his story if you come back. That's March the 7th, Lyle P. So, and if there's nothing else, I'd like to remind everybody that anonymity is a spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles for personalities. For those who will, please join us in the Lord's Prayer.
Seriously, can you take a sense?
It's over. Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory.